Is O come, O come, Emmanuel? Every who down in Whoville liked Christmas a lot. But the Grinch who lived just north of Whoville did not. The Grinch hated Christmas, the whole Christmas season. Now please don't ask why, no one quite knows the reason. It could be his head wasn't screwed on just right. It could be, perhaps, that his shoes were too tight, but I think that the most likely reason of all may have been that his heart was two sizes too small. Dr. Seuss's story of how the Grinch's heart went from painfully constricted to full and overflowing is to the 20th and 21st centuries what the night before Christmas was to the 19th. A celebration of Christmas as a secular holiday, a universal holiday. Christmas as it can belong to everybody, whatever they may believe about the birth or the nature of Jesus. The story of the Grinch and the Whos celebrates the sacred power of celebration itself, the human act of celebration. Celebrations do not always make everyone happy. They never have. When your team loses or you do, it can be galling to hear that winner's party going on next door. But what is the Grinch lost? What's he missing? Whatever the reason, his heart or his shoes, he stood there on Christmas Eve hating the Whos. Is it his heart? Something in his nature? Is it his tight shoes? His pain? Or something else about his experience and where those shoes have carried him? We don't know, but far from staying aloof and ignoring the Whos at Christmas, he stands in his cold cave, deeply engaged in their celebration by actively hating it and them. And you remember what the Grinch hates about the celebration. First thing. The first thing we hear about loud and clear is the noise, 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 noise. We hear it and we see it conveyed in Dr. Seuss's brilliant artwork. The first thing the Grinch hates is the noise of play. Playing games, playing music, and just sheer delighted play. That's probably the first thing we should all know about celebration, be it Christmas or Mardi Gras or a weekly worship service. It may represent a great deal of work in preparation. What do you think, worship team? Anything? A lot of work in preparation. Inner, outer, physical, and emotional work. But when it happens, it's play. We set it all up with a reverent attention to every detail. And then we play, as reverently as children play, if we do it well. And then things can get noisy. Let's not confuse reverence with silence, walking on eggs under sheets of stained glass. Reverence and some real noise go way back in human religious life. One of the most beautiful psalms in the Bible starts out by singing, "Make a joyful noise unto the Lord, make a loud noise, and rejoice and sing praise. All the earth, make a joyful noise, all the earth." I find this image of the whole world turned to music like a single elaborate musical instrument, connected by vibrations to its original moment, which we may conceive of as a big bang, and which the psalmist calls the Lord. I find this idea to be quite compelling, and in some ways perhaps quite true. The only image in all of our UU principles, the only place where they say what something might look like or feel like, is the image of the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Perhaps the web is best understood as something like a stringed instrument, as much as a spider's dwelling place. So make a joyful noise. But how does this echo in the joyless heart of the Grinch? That's the one thing he hated. The noise, 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 noise. Ah, he didn't hate just one thing. What's the next thing he hates? You remember? Then the who's young and old would sit down to a feast, and they'd feast, and they'd feast, and they'd feast, 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 feast. They would feast on who pudding and rare who roast beef, beasts, which was something the Grinch couldn't stand in the least. Feasting and fasting are both primordial forms of religious expression. Faith and memory, longing and craving can all be expressed in what we do as a group with bodily needs, like hunger. One of the purposes of the Ramadan fast in Islam is for everyone to feel in their bodies for a month what the poor feel every day by giving up food and drink from dawn to dusk, and to feel in their hearts what the lonely feel by giving up sex and intimate touch. I think that fasting is a powerful practice, though if the Who's did it, I'm sure the Grinch wouldn't approve. I also think that feasting has great positive value. Every now and then, it can be good to take in a little more, or even much more than usual. It may even be good for your health. I'm sure that it's good for a community's health. But whatever you feel about fasts or feasts, I'm sure we all agree that no one should starve. My friend and colleague Barbara Pishon writes in her poem of an encounter outside a church in Romania with a beggar who tried to get her sympathy by saying, "Jesus is Lord." Barbara writes, "Theologies flit through my mind, warnings against beggars, give to one and you will be surrounded. Jesus is Lord, he says. Not mine, no matter. The money in my pocket might have got him bread for a week. I had it. Did not give it. I am surrounded anyway." These lessons are not about theology or money, but bread, bread again, and once again, bread. Give to one beggar, and you'll be surrounded. I did not give it. I am surrounded anyway. All alone in his cold cave, the Grinch feels surrounded anyway by the feasting Who's. I wonder how long it's been since he's had a good meal. The fellow's a bachelor as well as a hermit, and bachelors often don't eat well, even if they sometimes eat a lot. I remember a college roommate who, gorging on things like a whole 24-ounce can of pineapple or a whole double-sized box of fish sticks, but I can't say he ate well. We eat better when we're in at least some kind of community, enjoying some companionship, taking bread together. Bread is the root of companionship. The pan part of the word means bread. Bread again, and once again, bread. I assume the Grinch is a bachelor. He's been estranged from others so long and so starkly that there's really almost a widowed feel to this cold old fellow in his cave. Although we see no sign that there ever was a Mrs. Grinch for him to mistreat. His dog, Max, seems to be his only companion. He suffers abuse from the Grinch, such as the antler tied on his head, pulling that huge sleigh filled with stolen goods, and the whip we see in the drawings. But Max bears it faithfully, along with the Grinch's envious rage. Good little buddies, our pets. Good little bodies. And what good little bodies the Who's are. Playing bodies, feasting bodies, happy bodies. I don't know of anyone who can match Dr. Seuss's talent for drawing characters whose faces glow with such non-arrogant self-satisfaction, who take such pleasure in their own bodies, their own being. Good little bodies, altogether good and good all together. The depth of the Who's enjoyment of themselves and each other is on every face. This is just what we don't see a trace of in the Grinch. But he feels it. He can't enjoy it, but it touches him in a palpable, physical way. How does it touch him? Listen. And then they do something he liked least of all. Every who down in Whoville, the tall and the small, would stand close together with Christmas bells ringing. They'd stand hand in hand, and the whos would start singing. They'd sing, and they'd sing, and they'd sing, 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 sing. And the more the Grinch thought of this who Christmas sing, the more the Grinch thought, I must stop this whole thing. Why, for 53 years I've put up with it now. I must stop this Christmas from coming. But how? How does the who's pleasure touch the Grinch? Through singing. Above all, it's this community singing that the Grinch wants to silence. I love the way Dr. Seuss puts it, this who Christmas sing, the way he nouns a verb, if you'll forgive me for verbing a noun. We can use the word voice correctly as either verb or noun. What do voices do? What do we do, whether human or who, when we voice them? Voices talk, or call, or laugh, or cry out, and voices sing. We make meaning with words, but even when we sound our voices wordlessly, we mean something by them. When I hear another's voice, our bodies touch, although our skins may not. I feel the pain of another, or their joy. Foreign words might go right by us, but almost all of us have been moved by the sound of a human voice singing in another language that we don't understand. Almost all of us have been moved by the voice of something that's not human, the whimper of a dog in pain, the purr of a cat. These voices still mean something. To our very bodies, they mean it. The who's hold each other's hands, but their singing touches the Grinch in a bodily way. He growled with his Grinch fingers nervously drumming. I must find some way to stop Christmas from coming. Those drumming fingers tell us something. Could they be itching to participate in all that singing and hand-holding, at least in some small way? Some small way. Now, speaking of small, his exchange with Emmy Lou Hu, who was no more than two, reveals how much thought he's given to the small details of the Christmas he's trying to steal. Santa Claus, why? Why are you taking our Christmas tree? Why? But you know, that old Grinch was so smart and so slick, he thought up a lie and he thought it up quick. Why, my sweet little tot, the fake Santa Claus lied. There's a light on this tree that won't light on one side, so I'm taking it home to my workshop, my dear. I'll fix it up there, and I'll bring it back here. The Grinch's quick recovery shows years of mastering his material. 53 years of hard study of Christmas. After all these repetitions, he's internalized Christmas completely. He just can't participate in it yet. He's not so much stealing Christmas as making it his own. In a bad way, yes, but still his own. I'll fix it up there, and I'll bring it back here. Please notice that his very first interaction with the who that we're aware of, maybe his first interaction ever, it's so easy to hate those who've never had any interaction with, his first interaction ends with a promise to return. In the illustrations, we can see that this is the first time his face has worn a smile that looks really pleasant instead of a smirk or an evil grin. The promise is part of a lie and an act, but somehow making this promise lets him show real pleasure. He tells the child he'll be back with the tree. I'll come back. I'll return. And that sounds just right to Emmy Lou Hu. After all, who does Emmy Lou think she's talking to? Remember? Santa Claus. The real Santa Claus. I'm sure that you've noticed that the real Santa never makes an appearance, never runs into the Grinch going down as he comes back up a chimney. Dr. Seuss is not teaching children to believe in Santa Claus any more than he's teaching them to believe that Jesus is Lord. You could say that Dr. Seuss is teaching us, children of all ages, as the saying goes, to be realistic about Christmas, but with a skill that's almost a small miracle in itself. He does it without stealing from Christmas any of its real magic and power. He does it all in the moment of the Grinch's transformation. It comes just as the Grinch pauses before completing his mission. He's stolen every tree, light, and gift, food for the feast, logs for the fires, loaded them on his sleigh, and gone 3,000 feet up the side of Mount Crumpet. He rode with his load to the tip-top to dump it. Poo-poo to the hooves, he was grinchishly humming. They're finding out now that no Christmas is coming. They're just waking up. I know just what they'll do. Their mouths will hang open a minute or two, and then the hooves down in Whoville will all cry, boo-hoo. He's imagined the pain he'll cause so intimately. It's the same intimacy with which he's studied every detail of Christmas. The moment of shock, then the tears. That's a noise, grinned the Grinch, that I simply must hear. So he paused, and the Grinch put a hand to his ear, and he did hear a sound rising over the snow. It started in low, and it started to grow, and now comes the Grinch's own moment of shock. Every who down in Whoville, the tall and the small, was singing without any presence at all. He hadn't stopped Christmas from coming. It came. Somehow or other, it came just the same. It's the singing that gets him. The thing he hated worst of all, of course. That distance-closing intimacy of voices put together. Breath and word and sounding flesh. Good little bodies, instruments of joy, spontaneously resisting the triumph of loss and joylessness, and overcoming it completely. Resisting the triumph of loss and joylessness, and overcoming it completely, which we better do. And the Grinch, with his Grinch feet ice cold in the snow, stood puzzling and puzzling. How could it be so? It came without ribbons, it came without tags, it came without packages, boxes, or bags. And he puzzled 3 hours till his puzzler was sore. Then the Grinch thought of something he hadn't before. Maybe Christmas, he thought, doesn't come from a store. Maybe Christmas, perhaps, means a little bit more. And with this little bit of understanding, the Grinch's heart grows those three sizes that have been famous for more than 53 years now. And so the Grinch brings back all the things of Christmas he has stolen and delivers them to the Whos, becoming the only Santa Claus we ever see in this story, a transformed Grinch. He fulfills the promise he made to a child who expected no less of him. He returns. He returns with what he has at last made his own in the only way he could think of, by stealing it. He unpacks Christmas for the Whos and for all of us. It's not the product of factories or stores or theologies. It's a superabundance of us, ourselves, and each other to share in song, touch, and feast. That's the real Christmas. The goods are just details. It's all about coming back, coming together, returning again. The Grinch returns to Christmas what had been there all along. The only new thing in this celebration is the Grinch himself. And he himself, the Grinch, carved the roast beast. He's here at last for the first time, unpacking Christmas and opening the feast by serving the food, putting a bit of himself on every plate like we do when we serve food. Wearing for the first time that unique Dr. Seuss look of non-arrogant self-satisfaction on his face. He's not become a who by celebrating with the who's any more than we become Christians by celebrating Christmas, but he has opened their feast by at last opening himself to it. He's ready to taste what they love. Maybe next he'll be singing, as comfortable as a child with all the repetitions and returns that mean Christmas, Christmas again, and once again, Christmas. There is a beautiful animated version of the Grinch story that you might have seen, made in the late 1960s. Chuck Jones directed, and Dr. Seuss himself wrote extra words and song lyrics to stretch out the story. When the Grinch's moment of transformation comes, we see an X-ray view of his heart growing three sizes. And his eyes change color from bloodshot red to bright blue. My son, who had torn that little corner off the page, noticed that color change when he was just a little more than two. He's nice now! He would yell. He'd yell that when watching the video over and over and over. After that, whenever we would see a mean character in a cartoon or a picture book, he would insist on transforming it into a nice version of itself. He would see a mean rat or something and say, "There's nice rats too." And he'd make mommy or daddy draw one with crayons. Once he got older, he would make all his drawings himself, including his share of bad guys and monsters. But ever since seeing the possibility of good in the Grinch, he continued to see the possibility for the same transformation in every cruel or spiteful character he came across. As he moves out further and further into the world, I hope he never